Hello, I'm Rosemary Puddy, and you're listening to The Book Podcast. Conversations, news and reviews with Australian women writers.
I certainly wanted to create a concept that could have happened, and if it did happen, perhaps this might be how it played out.
Hello, and thank you for joining me for our May episode of the Book Podcast. This month, I'm talking to Catherine Firkin about her new novel, The Girl Remains. The Girl Remains is a gritty crime thriller, continuing the series with Detective Emmett Corbin. Cassie Hamer will be along to talk about all things books and publishing, and later she'll join us to talk about our book of the month, which is Amanda Hampson's Lovebirds. So that's what we have for you in this month's episode. So let's get on with the show. Hi Cass, welcome back again. And what's happening in the world of publishing and books this month?
Well, lots of book lists are being produced, Rose. So by that I mean organisations that get readers to vote on their favourite books of all time, and then they publish those lists, and they always make for quite interesting reading in terms of what's really popular, what people are listing as their all-time favourite book. So one of those lists comes from Better Reading, which is a company that's really set up to encourage people to read, and they produce a list called their Top 100, which is voted on by readers. Now, what's really interesting about this list, there are a few interesting things actually, and one is that 65 of the top 100 books were written by women, which is fantastic.
It is.
There are 7 reads by women in the top 10 alone. 4 of the female authors in the top 10 are Australian, and in total 60% of the authors are Australian. So a really strong showing from local females in that list, but I want you to try and guess what the top one was. This is quite tricky. It's not an Australian woman. It is a woman.
Not an Australian woman, but it is a woman.
Yeah.
Obviously books from the last year, was that right?
Yeah, this one's from the last couple of years. Been a really big one.
Was it a controversial book?
Not really. Oh. No, it's not the one you're thinking of.
I'm thinking of Janine Cummins' book, but no.
Yeah, no, it wasn't that one. I'll put you out of your misery.
Do.
It was Where the Crawdads Sing.
Oh, I love that. Delia Owens. Love that. That was a fabulous book.
A really, really popular book. I have to admit, I really liked it, but I got a bit bogged down in all the plant biology and the sort of natural descriptions. But that said, a great story. And what's interesting is that Crawdads was number one in both the Better Reading list, but also in the Dimmicks top 101.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so interesting to see that, you know, it's number one in both of those lists. So definite confirmation that that has been a real crowd favourite. In the Better Reading one, the number two was the classic To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, and then The Dry by Jane Harper, Boy Swallows Universe by Trent Dalton, Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen next, and The Book Thief by Marka Zusak, which is always in the top 10 of these kinds of lists. Like, it's incredible how beloved that book is now, and it's got to be at least over a decade old.
Oh, so it has, yeah. And listen, I know you're not going to blow your own trumpet, and neither is Sandy Docker, but both girls who are, we're all in a team to do the Northern Beaches Readers Festival, but both you girls made that list.
Yes, we did. No one was more shocked than I was, that's for sure. But
you deserve it.
I was really chuffed, and the great bonus of that, of being on that list, is that now all the books in the top 100 are going to be stocked at Big W for the next year and at a really great price. So it's a real boost for any author to be included on a list like that. So I'm nothing but grateful to those who voted.
Hmm. That's true. And remember last month too, we were talking about the Arby Awards, and I don't know if you were going to get onto that. And you posed me another sticky question and said, who did I think would win? And you put your option up and I put mine, and you won, if you like.
Yes, I did. It was the Dictionary of Lost Words
by Pip Williams. Yes.
Yeah, which that one again was at, I think it was number 7 in the Better Reading Top 100 and was also in the Dimmicks Top 10 as well. So that one is just a phenomenon that seems to keep gathering pace, to be honest, because the other thing I was going to talk about is the books that hit the bestsellers list most recently. And so these are the books that were being sold in the lead up to Mother's Day, because the bestseller lists operate on a little bit of a lag. But interestingly, the Dictionary of Lost Words came roaring back just in time for Mother's Day. And I think it was off the back of those competition wins in the Arbias and in Better Reading and the Dimmicks Top 101. Those things really do count. And a lot of mothers obviously opened their gifts to find that book was a present for this Mother's Day. But the other weird thing about the most recent bestseller list is that the top selling book across all areas was a Bluey book. So you know what I mean by
yes,
Bluey.
Yes, I know. And Bluey, then, I love Bluey.
Yeah, so Bluey is also a publishing phenomenon, which those books are regularly topping the bestseller list. But so the book that was the big seller for Mother's Day was Bluey, My Mum is the Best. But I was sort of thinking, like, who's that a gift for? Is that then a gift from the mum to a kid to make the kid appreciate a mum? Or is that, I don't know.
Oh, I think that's dad's given the child a pocket money and he's gone, she'd love this Bluey book.
And look, to be fair, we are massive Bluey fans in this household. So my girls are 8, 10 and 12. But it's definitely one of our favourite family TV shows. It's really pitched at a preschool, early school audience. But I really think anyone of any age can appreciate the gentle but pointed humour that operates on, you know, two distinct levels. There's a lot of adult jokes in it and there's a lot of humour directed straight at the child audience. It's just a winner, and I'm not surprised the books are flying off the shelves.
No, I'm not at all surprised at that either.
And the other couple of books that sold really well, apart from the Dictionary of Lost Words, was the new one from Kelly Rimmer, which is The Warsaw Orphan. And Kelly's one of those sort of unsung publishing mega success stories in Australia that she keeps a relatively low profile on the sort of social media scene. I mean, she's there and easy to find and she's a really lovely person, but not one to blow her own trumpet, even though she has been on best-selling lists in the States for years now. And her books here are also gaining a lot of traction. So the new one, I don't know if I said it, it's called The Warsaw Orphan. So sounds like one of those ones where it might be a dual historical sort of
one. Yeah, I think it is. And she's a lovely girl. She's out in Orange, isn't she, in New South Wales in the country?
Yeah, she is. She is. And she's a really good citizen of the writing community, but very modest, which again, is absolutely lovely. So it's great to see that her new one is also doing really well. But that's it from me for this week in terms of publishing news.
That's fantastic. And we'll talk again next month.
Thanks, Rose.
My interview this month is with Catherine Firkin. Catherine is a Melbourne journalist currently with CBS New York. She has over a decade of experience and has worked across every medium, print, online, television, and radio. Catherine has been writing fiction from a young age, and she studied literature and journalism at university. Her debut novel, Sticks and Stones, was inspired by the many criminal trials that she has covered. And today we're talking about her new book, The Girl Remains. On the evening of the 22nd of September 1998, in the coastal town of Blairgowrie, three teenage girls venture out for a night of mischief, but only two return. For over 20 years, the disappearance of 15-year-old Celia May remains a baffling cold case until human bones are discovered on an isolated beach. Now it's up to Detective Emmett Corbin and his team to dig through decades of trauma and find the missing piece of an investigation that's as complex as it is tragic. But the police aren't the only ones hunting for the truth. A mysterious woman has arrived in the seaside town, and she's prepared to do whatever it takes to find her own version of justice. Catherine Firkin is a Melbourne journalist, currently with CBS New York. I talked to Catherine about her debut novel, Sticks and Stones, in September last year, and she's back with me today to talk about her new crime thriller, The Girl Remains. Hi, Catherine. Welcome back to the book podcast.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Oh, you're very welcome. Look, what a year it's been for authors and journalists alike, and for everybody else, of course. But it's been a very productive time for you with the launch now of your second novel. And this is a story of a reopening of a cold case. A girl has gone missing, but 20 years ago. But just thinking about this novel and reading this novel, were there any real life cases that influenced this book? You know, cases that struck a chord with you, stayed with you?
Yeah, there really were. And I'm sort of glad that at the moment, the feedback, a lot of people keep asking me, is this real? Because it feels real to them. Yes. And I really love that feedback because I certainly wanted to create a concept that could have happened. And if it did happen, perhaps this might be how it played out. The story itself, though, is absolutely fictional. But I certainly did look at a couple of cases that are really quite notorious in Victoria and probably right across Australia to influence my writing. One of them was the murder of a little six-year-old girl called Cherie Beasley, which was back in 1991. She actually disappeared just near where this book is set in Rosebud. It's pretty much one suburb up from where my three girls go out and things start to get into trouble. And this little girl, she sort of vanished almost in the middle of the day, cycling her bike to a milk bar. And it was just a really horrific crime that absolutely rattled the neighbourhood. So I actually spoke to a lead detective involved in that investigation in real life to get a bit of assistance in terms of how police actually solved those sorts of crimes back then in the 90s and what they would do now if it was reopened as a cold case.
The new book, The Girl Remains, it's a gritty crime thriller. But this time, instead of setting it in inner city Melbourne, you've chosen the Mornington Peninsula as the setting. And I know you just mentioned there Rosebud, but you've got a particular affinity with that area, don't you?
I do. I mean, I still wanted, you know, to continue with my lead detective, Emmett Corbin. So I needed to choose a location that was still within travelling range from his headquarters in Melbourne. But Blairgowrie is a town that I went to a lot as a child. I was lucky enough to have a friend at primary school. Her parents had a little beach shack down there. And it was the first place that I went as a teenager without parents. And so I really felt like I understood my characters, that sense of excitement and freedom that teenagers get when they finally get rid of the parents and sort of, you know, have this adventure on their own. And a place like Blairgowrie on the Mornington Peninsula, it is the sort of place that many parents would let their teenagers perhaps have those first adventures because generally it is very safe. It's very small. It's quite contained. And, you know, most people know each other down there.
Well, that's true, but it's a small town. And you often find in crime thrillers that small towns, whether they're coastal or rural, they make great settings for a thriller. So why do you think that is? Is it because it's that small town mentality and because everybody does know each other?
I think there's something really creepy about the feeling of perhaps misjudging your neighbours. You know, that idea of was there a monster living amongst us this whole time and we didn't know about it. And I think, you know, that's a hard feeling to create in a city setting. You know, in a city it's sort of understood that you're not going to know everybody and there are going to be bad people wandering amongst you. But when you're in a small town and you do get to know the local community, you know your neighbours, everyone pops down to the general store, it just feels that extra bit shocking when something goes wrong.
And when something does go wrong, if there has been sort of, if you like, a stranger or someone new to the area, suspicion often does fall on them.
Absolutely. And what I like about Blairgowrie and that whole peninsula region is it's an interesting demographic. During the winter months, it's really sleepy and quiet, and the only people there are the real locals, and they really do all know each other. But of course, in the summer, you get this influx of tourists and holiday makers and people just down for the day. So it's a very interesting dynamic where you do get the sort of strangers walking amongst the locals. And it's interesting when you have a crime like this, you know, whether people turn and point their finger at their neighbours or whether they immediately will suspect the stranger from out of town.
Absolutely. Now, I know you said you did spend a lot of time in Blairgowrie, and you did say in your acknowledgements that you didn't get up to any mischief down there, but did you have a wonderful teenage time down there?
I feel so lucky to have had my teenage years in the 90s when I set this book without mobile phones, without all the, you know, the pressure that I feel like modern day girls do, particularly girls, do have. And so, you know, my memories of Blairgowrie was just this absolute freedom and that excitement of, you know, maybe staying out a bit too late and maybe chatting to some boys in the supermarket and going to house parties and all those sorts of things. And you did it with a real sense of naivety and sort of, yeah, this real innocence. And that's really what I've tried to capture with these three girls in The Girl Remains, that they are heading out sort of almost in that sort of giggly excitement, but they never really expect things to go so terribly wrong.
No, and it is that naivety, isn't it? As a teenager, you don't even realise that there could be dangers in the things that you do.
No, and I love teenagers as characters because they're quite secretive generally. You know, they really often are living lives that their own parents don't really know about. Quite often they're not telling any, you know, responsible adult what they're getting up to. And sometimes they're not even telling each other what they're really getting up to. And I think that makes them very interesting characters because they don't necessarily even tell police the full story when they sort of have to explain what they were doing.
That's true. And it's very sketchy when the cold case gets opened. Look, let me just go back a moment. So in Sticks and Stones, you did introduce us to Detective Emmett Corbin. He returns again to investigate. Now, human remains are found on an isolated beach. So tell us a little bit about this case, because that sketchy memory and the sketchy evidence comes into play in the case.
That's right. And that's where sort of the interesting, sort of almost vague, secretive teenagers also come into play. So these three teenage girls, they head out one night for a little bit of mischief. You know, they're just being a bit cheeky and a bit silly, and they head out on this really dark, sort of almost creepy night with a red blood moon in the sky and things like that. And only two of them come back. And the two survivors that come back from this trip are really not able to tell police what happened. They're quite confused. They're a little bit traumatized. They think they might have heard things out in the bushes, but they're not really sure. And their story sort of keeps almost changing or just sort of emerging as they tell their tales. And so for police back then in 1998, it's really confusing and it's extremely frustrating because they just cannot work out what happened to this 15-year-old girl who just seemed to disappear into the night. Unfortunately for them, the lead goes cold and the whole case rests for 20 years until, as you mentioned, human remains are found on the beach, almost exactly the location where she disappeared 20 years later.
Yeah. Well, you've given Emma a couple of new offsiders too in this book. You've got DSC Lan Yuguan and an old acquaintance of Emmett's, Bianca Tardio. Now, both of these characters, they're very different personalities. So tell us how Emmett feels about them joining the team.
Yeah, well, I wanted to keep, you know, Emmett moving. When we first met him in Sticks and Stones, he was in the missing persons unit and he had a very, very small team that was run under homicide. He's now moved to the cold case team and here he has to work even closer with homicide, which is a really large team, as you can imagine, within Victoria Police. So he's got two detectives that are both quite different and they come from quite different backgrounds. Bianca Tardio is quite experienced. She comes from homicide. She's really quite rough and ready in many ways. There's not much that rattles her. She's sort of seen everything. She's really quite a strong, independent, sort of fiery type of character. And then Detective Lan Yuan, he's much younger. He's probably a little more inexperienced. He tends to investigate on gut feeling, which Emmett doesn't really appreciate. Emmett's quite a practical person who wants to see the evidence and just follow the evidence. Whereas Lan tends to sort of get feelings that something's not quite right. And he's almost a little bit scatterbrained in his approach to investigating. So between the three of them, you know, none of them really do things quite the same. But I think that in some ways actually helps the investigation move forward.
No, it was a lovely touch that in the book that in the midst of this really gritty and horrible crime, there's some very funny moments.
Yeah, and I really did try to inject a bit of personality into the detectives. I think sometimes in crime novels, you know, you can have detectives cast almost a little bit cardboard cutout-y. You know, they're sort of the burly, hefty sort of people stomping through, and that's all they ever are. But, you know, I wanted to give my detectives, you know, a few little quirky characteristics and really make them very human.
They certainly were, yes. I made me laugh out loud a couple of those things. But in the first book, we met Emma, and we also met his wife, Cindy, and she's back again in this book. But you've created a very different look at her personality. You've created a deeper look at the dynamic of their relationship.
Yeah, this is something that I felt like I personally understood. You know, in my personal life, my husband and I have both worked on different sides. I've always been in media and journalism. He's worked sometimes on the more, you know, communications and strategy side. And sometimes we've actually been in situations where our roles are conflicting. And it's a very interesting dynamic when you're in a personal relationship with someone and then you've also got a professional conflict going on. And it's something I feel like I really know and understand. And Cindy's an interesting character. In The Girl Remains, she's really continued that passion she had for photography, and she's picked up a few casual shifts with the Australian Associated Press, the AAP, and she's really excited by this. It's given her almost a new lease on life. She's found a new career. She's actually quite good at it. So, of course, she wants to do the job to her best of the abilities, but sometimes that means conflicting with Emish, and she's a bit of a polarizing character. Some people have already told me they really hate her and they think she's just getting in the way and being really selfish. Personally, I have a lot of sympathy for her, and I feel like, as you said, it's almost like we're getting a deeper look into her psyche and what's really motivating her, and perhaps maybe giving us some clues about how frustrated she was previously.
I absolutely agree. I didn't dislike her at all. I mean, in the end, I came to like her quite a lot, because she has her life and her passion and her career, and he has his. And like you say, when they cross over, it's a very, very difficult line to walk.
Personally, I think Cindy's quite a human character. She certainly makes some mistakes and she makes a few poor choices, but, I mean, don't we all?
Yes.
I was a bit surprised when a few people said to me, oh, I hate her, she's just so selfish. And I thought, oh, That's not quite how I see her. But, you know, everyone, of course, you know, has a right to view the characters as they choose. But
yeah.
I do think perhaps she's a little misunderstood. And, you know, that conflict between her and Emmett, it's probably only going to continue playing out until they reach, you know, a bit of a resolution.
Yes, and I felt that she shouldn't have to sacrifice her career or her passion for him, even though sometimes that does cross the line a little bit. But anyway, you've worked as a court reporter in the past, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier on, but what research did you have to go into to understand how the police would go about opening and investigating a cold case like this now, as opposed to back when the case happened?
The first thing that I really try to do with my novels, as much as they are fictional, because I've written police procedurals, it is important to me that the policing aspect is realistic. It doesn't have to be 100% true, you know, the entire time, but it needs to have a sense of realism that this could have happened. So I did, as I mentioned, I did actually use a lead detective in a missing girl case set around the same time and location as my book, and he was just so fabulously helpful, giving me all these sort of little tips and tricks on how police might try to move the investigation forward. In my story, you know, they have a suspect, they think they know who's done it, and they just can't quite crack him. So I had some great conversations with a detective in real life about how police might actually try to almost trick a suspect into talking or leading them to evidence. But the other part of the book that required a bit of research, which I didn't really expect when I first came up with the story, was the element of forensic anthropology and how police actually go about getting sort of identification from human remains, how long that process might take, and also, you know, what clues they can actually get from bones. That was quite an important thing for me. Although I don't go into a lot of detail in the book because I don't want to weigh the story down, I did a fair bit of research to make sure that I wasn't, you know, way off in terms of the timeline of how long something might take or what they might need to see. You know, are the bones affected by salt water? Have they been washed up? Have they been, all those sorts of things. were quite important to me that I got them reasonably accurate.
And actually, in that research, you would have come across a lot of people think from watching things like CSI that, 60 minutes with ad breaks, it takes a long time for forensics.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, with a novel, you've got to keep moving it forward so you don't have those months and things that sometimes testing can take. Having said that, it is interesting how quickly police can move when they've got political pressure on them and when a case is high profile. So I do think, you know, part of what I looked at was how can I make sure that this case gets prioritised quickly and get accurate testing done within a reasonable time frame to keep the reader still interested. But you're absolutely right. Some of those TV shows make me laugh because it's like overnight they've got the identification, they've worked out every little bit of this character's backstory just from one bone, and I think, oh my gosh, it's just not.
If only that was true. Possible. Yes, that's right. In your research and talking to this to the detective, apart from the technology, was there anything different that happened in their police procedure then to now?
I think what's really interesting is when you take away mobile phones, you really get rid of a lot of the instant sort of data that police these days would be sifting through. So if someone went missing right now, the first thing they're doing is looking at, you know, GPS tracking, they're looking at text messages, social media posts, all those sorts of things. And I really wanted to get rid of that, partly because, you know, it makes cases more mysterious when you take that little computer out of people's pockets. But it also can be a little bit tedious to just be trawling through all those sorts of almost statistical type evidence as far as the story goes. So I really, you know, wanted to make sure that I could, you know, work in a setting where I could get rid of the mobile phone, but also keep it realistic. You know, back then police were very much boots on the ground type investigating. You know, they were door knocking, they were talking to neighbours, they were, you know, going to the local pub and trying to, you know, overhear conversations. And it was very much that sort of old school type of policing, which I think works so well in crime novels.
It certainly does. But in any sensational criminal case, media attention is a constant. So as a reporter, can you speak to us about your relationship with police investigations? Was it collaborative or combative?
That's a great question. And the honest answer is it's always a little bit of both. You know, I think the general public probably sometimes see the media like we're just scavengers and we turn up at the crime scene and we just kind of get in the way as we pick over the carcass. But that's not really the way it works most of the time. I mean, there are times when we get in the way of police investigations and they'll tell us, you know, not too politely that we are getting in the way and we need to leave them alone. But there are also times where we work quite closely with the police, and that's something I sort of tried to show in The Girl Remains, is this interesting dynamic between journalists and police. I mean, personally, I've had times when I've had like a TV news story air and my phone will ring 5 minutes later and it's a detective saying, oh, can you help me? Did you get the details of that witness you spoke to? We haven't been able to get onto them, or something they've said was really important. Do you think you can help us track them down? And so you actually do have a little bit of a helping role at times. There are also times where police will come up to you quietly and say, look, off the record, we really need this key piece of information put out far and wide. We've got someone under surveillance. We need them. We're trying to see if they'll react. Can you make sure you really, you know, do a big thing about whatever? It might be, you know, some CCTV or something. And so we will really try to push that out there as a way to help them see if they can rattle a suspect. And then there are times when police deliberately mislead us. And that's obviously very frustrating for us as journalists, when you feel like you've been played. But there are times when they will deliberately push us in one direction, again, because maybe they're doing something behind the scenes they don't want us, you know, and everyone knowing about, or sometimes they're just trying to trick someone into relaxing and thinking they've got away with an aspect of a crime.
Yeah. And in the same token, though, do they come to you and say, please don't release this?
Yeah. That happens, I mean, really quite often, where they'll say, look, we haven't told anyone yet about blah. I mean, it's often at crime scenes when you see them bring out evidence, sometimes you might be able to identify something, even if it's in the evidence bag, for example, spades or things like that, that are quite, you know, hard to conceal. And they'll ask us, please don't show footage of that if that's the murder weapon or whatever it is, because perhaps the only person who knows the murder weapon is the killer. And they're trying to keep those sort of pieces of information and evidence under wraps.
But you've told this story from several points of view and in two timelines. So drawing all the multiple threads together, did you know exactly where the story was going to take you?
I always have a really strong idea of who's done it and why they've done it. For me, that's very important from the get-go. I mean, I have spoken to some authors who will literally write crime novels and not know who the killer is. And for me, that's just way too terrifying a way to write. But I always have a very strong idea of who's my offender, why have they done what they've done. You know, that, and that really will inform the way the plot weaves. But I don't have every little, you know, chapter and every sort of milestone in the book plotted out. Quite often I get surprised myself as I get going at the twists and turns a case will take. And I think that comes with, I mean, I really like writing with a bit of freedom and a bit almost freestyling my way through the book. It's a little bit of a scary way to write, but it gives you some really creative moments where I think if I had sat down and just tried to plot an entire book, I would probably not have been able to get there myself.
Was there a character that turned up in this book that wasn't there originally in your thinking?
I don't think so, actually. No, that there was the case with Sticks and Stones where a character popped in that I wasn't expecting. But with this one, I had a very, very clear idea of the cast and they didn't really change too much.
Well, this is your second Emmett Corbin story. And when you first penned Sticks and Stones, were you planning for it to be a series?
I think I've always was. I was certainly always planning, you know, to keep writing and, you know, to really push to sort of try and build up a bit of a, you know, a backlog almost to get my name going. But I don't know if I was certain I was going to make a series out of it. I think as I got going with Sticks and Stones, I really liked Emmett Corbin as a character. I liked all the little backstories I'd created with him and the characters. And I could see his team growing and changing, which to me gives it enough interest to keep it moving. I don't think he'll ever be static. You know, I don't think his team will ever be exactly the same, because also I do, again, realistically, he's going to be working in such a big team within Victoria Police that it gives me a great opportunity to keep adding and changing characters in and out. But yeah, I think there will be a third one. I just don't know that will be my next book.
Okay, but you're certainly doing this, creating a series. It does give you a chance, doesn't it, to delve deeper into Emmett's working life and his private life and emotionally what's going on with him.
Absolutely, and I've already got, you know, sort of the plan for what I think will be book three with some twists in his own life and with a few of his closer detectives. They're going to play slightly more significant roles. But I've already got myself really deeply involved in a manuscript that's completely different at the moment. So I think I'm going to finish that, see if that works out, and then go from there.
Oh, I hope, Philo, though, when you do bring Emmett back, is it possible that Lana and Bianca will be with him, or are you going to move on to a bigger and different team?
I think they will be back. I think Bianca will definitely be back.
Because I liked her.
She'll play a big role in book three. Yeah, I like her too. She's got a great... I mean, she's the sort of person I'd like to be friends with, you know, she's kind of fun and no nonsense.
She's very much no nonsense. Yeah, I did love that about her.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think she will definitely be back. Lan, I'm still in two minds about, but I do like him. He's a fun character.
There's lots you can do with him, I'm sure. But you said you're deep into another manuscript. Can you tell us anything about that one?
Yeah, it's quite different. And I mean, again, I'm hoping this will be book three. I've got to get to the end and make a decision that I'm really happy with it. But at the moment, I'm really excited. It's actually set in America, where I've been living the last 2 years, on a small island off Long Island called Shelter Island. It's a very small little community. And I visited there just for a summer holiday last year and just thought, oh, I have to set a book here. It's just so creepy. It's sort of got a... ghostly, yeah, I hope no one from Shelter Island's listening. It's got a ghostly sort of Stepford Wives type feel to it.
Yeah.
Perfectly manicured.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I was going to say, is that Shelter Island that there was a Leonardo DiCaprio film set there?
I think there was. And the thing, I didn't actually know this until after I visited and thought, I've got to set a book here.
Yes, because it was really creepy.
Something, yeah, there is. And you get there and you think, something's just not quite right about this island, and I don't know what it is, but yeah, it is that sort of overly manicured big lawns, but every house feels empty, and I can't quite describe it, but it's just got a creepy feeling, and I really would love to have my book set there.
Well, you are working as a journalist with CBS New York, and have you been able to travel it, or are you still working online with that terribly challenging time change between the US and Melbourne?
I am still working a little bit from Melbourne, but I'm taking a couple of weeks off at the moment to do all the books that are promotion, and I'm loving the fact this time Melbourne's not in lockdown particularly, but I've also been in Sydney. I can actually go to bookstores and do events and meet people. It's a very different experience from when Sticks and Stones came out right in the middle of that big lockdown in Victoria, certainly. So, you know, I'm really actually enjoying that and getting to talk about book two. But I will have to, unfortunately, get back to work pretty soon.
Well, you have to go back to New York. Can you travel back now?
Yeah, I'll be heading back in probably 3 or 4 weeks. And I've also got the Olympics coming up in Japan, which is interesting and a bit controversial, but that's also on my schedule of things to cover. So that'll be another project I've got.
That's right, because we haven't talked about that, because you have done a fair bit of sports journalism, haven't you?
Yeah, I actually started out as a sports reporter, and I never imagined I would end up in crime and court reporting. That sort of all happened quite organically, and I fell in love with it and realized there was probably bigger stories than what was happening, you know, in the local football club. But you know, it is nice to every so often get thrown back into it when I'm needed.
And going back to New York in a few weeks' time, I have to ask you a personal question here. How's Morris handled the situation?
Morris is my Scottish Terrier, who I love probably more than anything, and I'm probably more obsessed with him than I should be. And leaving him is always the hardest part of leaving home. I did make the decision when I first went over that I would not bring him, and I'm glad that I didn't, given the pandemic and trying to get animals back into Australia at the moment is a nightmare. But it is getting incredibly tough to keep leaving him, so... Oh, if, you know, if I can get that big Netflix deal and get the private jet, that'd be great. I don't think that's anywhere in my immediate future, but you never know.
Never say never, Catherine. Never say never.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to read Sticks and Stones to enjoy Catherine Firkin's latest novel, The Girl Remains, but I recommend that you do, because they're both addictive and hugely entertaining crime thrillers. Catherine, I really enjoyed meeting Emmett again, and I'm looking forward to his next investigation after this other book. So I want to just say good luck with life both here and in New York, and thank you so much for being my guest today on the book podcast.
Oh, thank you so much again, Rosemary.
We're back again with Cassie, and the book we're talking about this month is Lovebirds by Amanda Hansen, and it's a book that says not all marriages end in happily ever after. Cassie, take it away. Tell us a little bit about the story on this book.
Yeah, this is a really lovely read. So it centres around Elizabeth, who's a 67-year-old former corrections officer and rehabilitation programs worker. Now, she has a best friend of more than 5 decades called Ginny. And when we meet Elizabeth, she's heading back to her former hometown of Nullarbura for Ginny's funeral. She goes back there with her budgie Eric in the backseat of the car. And there she sort of has a mixed greeting, I suppose. She doesn't quite fit in, and Ginny's family don't quite receive her in the way that she's hoping, because she's obviously very grief-stricken about her friend's death. She wants to deliver a eulogy, but the family deny her that opportunity. And then Ginny's husband, Paul, gives her a letter. And in the letter, Ginny really exhorts her to fix some long-running family issues and to sort of make peace or make things right with her estranged husband, of who she's not seen in 30 years, and his name is Ray. So Elizabeth has a few problems on the boil, and some of those problems also include a son who's in jail for assaulting a business partner, and that son's son, so Elizabeth's grandson, is also in strife. He's sort of running off the rails. He set fire to the local surf club, and his mum, Claire, who's Elizabeth's daughter-in-law, is having a lot of trouble sort of managing him. So Elizabeth agrees to take care of him for a while, and they both set out on a road trip to go and track down Ray, who's been living for the last 3 decades on the far north coast of New South Wales. So it is quite a sort of a road trip story, I suppose, in parts, but it actually has this really lovely structure where we switch between present day, and then we flip back to Elizabeth's upbringing in Nullarbora from the moment that she meets Ginny at the age of 10 to where she meets Ray, to where their marriage and romance develops and they relocate to the city. And I don't want to say too much more because it unfolds in such a lovely and gentle way that I just don't want to give away too many of the secrets in the book. But it really is a lovely read. It's all in Liz's point of view. And it actually reminded me of a couple of other books I've read and really enjoyed, one of which is The Secret Life of Shirley Sullivan, which is by Lisa Ireland, and also reminded me of Tess Woods's book, which is Love and Other Battles.
Oh, and I love that. Yes, that was a great book too.
Yeah, I thought that was great too. And what those two books share is this theme around the Vietnam War and the trauma that it caused to the soldiers who fought there. And that's a really moving aspect of Lovebirds. I hadn't really considered how young men's lives were really taken away from them. I mean, they went off to war without a choice, often in many cases, if they were conscripts. They had no choice to be there. They found themselves in a war that they didn't want to fight. They saw many traumatic things, and they came home to a largely unappreciative home audience, or, you know, family and friends who didn't necessarily believe in the war, but, you know, what choice did these young men have but to be there? So this book really sensitively portrays just how devastating that war was, not just for the soldiers there, but also for the wives and children who had to then also deal with the trauma that had been caused to these soldiers. So for me, that was one of the real strengths of the book. And I think the other thing that Amanda Hampson looks at really well is just the challenges of aging and the invisibility that women of a certain age start to feel, and the sort of powerlessness in a way. Like, Elizabeth always has the best of intentions and she wants to get involved in her family's lives, but she's not always quite sure how to do it. And, you know, she has this one son who's in jail and the other son who has married a woman who I think is Chinese, yeah. And so Elizabeth is just very awkward in terms of understanding the cultural customs of that family, and so she sort of messes up and comes across as her being racist. And so it's just really cleverly and beautifully
really
done.
Is. And so, and it's got a lot of humour in it as well. I mean, particularly because because of the budgie as well. It's a very funny episode all the way through that book with the budgie that she carts around on the road trip. But when I first looked at this book and looked at the blurb, I thought it's going to be a lovely, gentle story, and it is. But I was surprised, like you just said, at the depth that Amanda went through, because it's about love and loss in all of its variations and generational trauma as well.
I agree. And you can see that both Tom's problem, who is Ray's son, and he's the one who's ended up in jail, and then Zach's issues probably all stem from the same root cause, and that's this trauma that hasn't really been addressed from the Vietnam War. So I think you're right. Amanda Hampson does go a lot deeper than what I'd anticipated. And that cover blurb, you know, not all marriages end in happily ever after, is just so apt. But it's not the happy ever after in terms of, you know, This is not a frilly romance in any way, shape or form. This is a deep study of marriage and commitment over many decades, I think. And Elizabeth is not a perfect character. She does mess up a lot. And that's one of the reasons, I suppose, she's so endearing. But, yeah, the budgie is such a great highlight. He's sort of like this really inappropriate Greek chorus. He says the worst things at the most inopportune times, and it makes for great comedy, and of course relates so beautifully to the
Absolutely,
title.
Absolutely, it does. That's what I loved about it too. It's that thematic of being in a cage, and being let out of the cage, like freedom, and there were all sorts of things going on underneath this story that you didn't realise. You come back and look at the cover, and it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's the thing about this book. It's quite deceptive. And I mean, there were moments, I don't often cry in books, but there were moments where I was really brought to tears, and I can't even explain what they were without giving a whole lot of plot away. But just rest assured that this book will touch even the hardest.
It will catch
hearts,
you in the heart for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I think I would definitely recommend this one. Amanda Hampson, it's definitely not her first book. I think it's her
fifth book.
Yeah, and she's a really assured novelist, and I think it's the kind of book that you could give to any woman, probably any man in your life. I'd say probably from the ages of 30 upwards, and I think that they would really get something out of it.
Sorry, I'm just looking at Amanda's book here, and it is actually her sixth book.
Oh, her sixth. Yeah, no surprises there. You can just tell when an author knows what they're doing, and Amanda Hampson really does know what she's doing in this book. So definitely one that I would happily recommend to a lot of different people.
Me too. I really enjoyed it.
Fantastic. Well, that was a fun chat, Rose. I'm looking forward to our next one.
Indeed. Next month, I think we're going to be looking at Cassandra Austin's book called Like Mother.
Ooh, that sounds good. I've been seeing that one around lately, so I can't wait for that.
We'll talk to you again next month.
Thanks, Rose.
And that's all we have for you. Information about all of the topics and books mentioned on the show today will be available on our website, thebookpodcast.com. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at The Book Podcast, and you can listen wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the show.